the storyline of the Bible is always, and this will become very important when we think about what the tower actually is, it's always God condescending to us instead of us going up to him.
This is how the Old Testament mind thought. And then the prophets are coming and saying, and one day you will be the temple. You will be the priest. You will house him. Welcome to Kingdoms Unveiled, and today I'm excited because we definitely get to go into the parts of our Bibles that are confusing, that are often cluttered, and the veil has been pulled over, and we don't see the wonder and the glory of who our King is, and the hope that we have beyond the grave. Your hosts today are Doug Van Dorn, who is the pastor of the Northern Reformed, we'll get there. The Reformed Baptist Church of Northern Colorado. There we go. I got it.
The U. That's what the guys always say when they're playing football. You know, I go to Oklahoma State, Nebraska. The U.
The U. And I am John Moffitt of Grace Reformed Church in Spring Hill, Tennessee. Two Reformed Baptists who love confessional theology. And our goal is definitely to introduce you to the sides of your Bible that, well, we skip them in our reading plans, and we don't want to do that today. Well, today is a fun one, and we're going to do our best. We're probably going to have to turn this into two episodes, so bear with us. We're going to do kind of a setup part in the first half, and then you'll have to come back next week, and we'll do our best to finish it. We're still working through this idea of the divine council, sons of God, looking at your Bible and allowing stories like Genesis 3 and Genesis 6 to influence the way in which we understand the entire Bible. I think we set this up in the first few episodes, Doug, in that there's a seed war between the seed of Eve and the seed of the serpent, and it just continues to play out throughout the rest of the story. And if this is your first episode, we really are kind of building on like a story. So you might want to go back to the first episode that Doug and I did where we introduce the spiritual warfare of Genesis 6, so and the sons of God and divine counsel. So I would start there. We're going to kind of build off of that. What we have today is foundational and it is fun, but just stick with this. I know this is going to be strange sometimes, Doug. I know this look that people get on their face. It's like their head starts to tilt and they start to squint and they're like, this guy is, he's off his rocker. So, but there's a lot of biblical evidence for what we have. So we're gonna go to a famous story. I think every child hears this story as they're growing up. You know, did you grow up in the flannelgraph stage?
Oh yeah,
Doug. Where they? They put him up on the.
And the same guy was like 25 different characters of the Old Testament.
You're right. This was Joseph, Daniel, and Abraham. my mom, man, she was my Sunday school teacher for years, and lots of flannelgraph stories, and she had these big, huge tubs full of them. I don't even know where they're at now. Anyways, the Tower of Babel is probably one of the most famous stories, and the way in which it was presented, like a lot of things, it's just very foolish people who just are almost cave dwellers. You know, these are Neanderthal people who just are so uneducated that they would create idols and worship them that aren't real, and they would worship false gods, you know, gods that aren't real out of rocks. And then all of a sudden, one day they thought, you know, we're going to build a tower so we could go up and be with God. And that's how the Tower of Babel is presented to us, in that it's just kind of these foolish people, and God looks down on them and waves his finger and says, how foolish are you to think you could build a tower to me? And so I'm going to divide you up into different nations and confuse your language. And this is how the story is presented to us.
You know, I grew up in Denver, but first time I went to New York City, I don't know if you were like me, maybe in Chicago too, but New York City is kind of more iconic, even though Chicago had the taller building. But I remember seeing Empire State Building in the World Trade Centers for the first time, and my mind went to Tower of Babel. I'm like, look, they're building the Tower of Babel. And why? Because really tall building. That was the only thing that connected it in my mind.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I guess it's easy when you just imagine like, well, we have technology today, we have computers, we have electricity. These people didn't. So they were just really ignorant. They were just, you know,
very foolish. They
actually thought
they could get up to heaven.
Yeah.
Like if they just get high enough, they can touch the dome.
That's right. As if they've never seen a mountain before or been on top of a mountain. I don't think you can build a building bigger than a mountain. Or, Doug, or is the Tower of Babel a mountain? So I'm going to throw it over to you. That's the basic introduction to the story. But this Tower of Babel is extremely significant when it comes to, one, understanding the story of God's interaction, or the God's interaction with humanity, and really the ultimate hope that we have of being restored to our King and our God. So, Doug, tell us about what the Tower of Babel story actually should be understood if we were to read Genesis 3, 6, and then we hit the Tower of Babel, understanding the divine counsel, understanding the gods, the interactions of it. What is the Tower of Babel?
Okay, so there's lots of different ways you could go with this. Heiser introduced to folks this interesting idea that there's not really one fall in the scripture. There's three falls in the scripture. That's kind of his language. It is good. I think he diminished Genesis 3 way too much.
Yeah.
And I actually think intertestamental literature deals with Genesis 3 more than he gave credit for. But nevertheless, his point is very interesting. All three of them are supernatural stories in one way or another. That's where we'll end up getting to by the end of whenever it takes us to be done with this talk on the Tower of Babel. But in the meantime, as we think about it being a fall, there's one thing I want to bring out as Reformed Christians. This for it doesn't just have to be Reformed, but for us, because we're covenantal and stuff like that. I think it's we're the people who I've seen point this out more often than anyone else, but I don't see them pointing it backwards. I see them pointing it forward. So in Genesis 11:4, they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves." So the way that this goes forward is that they're going to build a name for themselves, and of course it ends in a dispersion. However, Noah had a son, and that son's name was Shem. And Shem, that name means name. And what's so interesting about it is that Shem becomes the one through whom Abram will be born. And so really, the Tower of Babel in a biblical theological setting is playing off this idea of a name, that the men are going to make a name for themselves, but God is making a name for himself through something that's very, very different than what the people were doing. Now, where I've never seen them take it backwards to is that we actually have an antecedent to this in Genesis 6:4, where the Nephilim are men of renown, or men of the name.
Interesting.
And so what you have then in the two of the three fall stories, if you want to call them that, in Genesis 6 and Genesis 11, is you have this kind of anti-name, this people wanting to make a name for themselves, these demigods, or in this case, people or whatever. They want to make a name for themselves. But the storyline of the Bible is always, and this will become very important when we think about what the tower actually is, it's always God condescending to us instead of us going up to him. He always makes covenants with us. Our job isn't to make a covenant with him. And so the man of the name that God will make a covenant with, of course, is Abram. And then he will change his name to the father of many nations. So that's one level of the storyline that's not that hard to understand, but it's very rich and super interesting to think through.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. Yeah, the connection, men of renown, men of the name, and the idea of the of God condescending to us and making the covenant with us. It's like the setup of the gospel is almost in every chapter, if you step back and just keep looking at the whole arc of the story. Because what does it say? What does it say in Paul says that he humbled himself, right? He brought himself down to be a man. He came to us and became the fulfillment of the new covenant. He fulfilled the promise of the seed to Eve. So I love that. This is why this conversation, and Doug and I get so excited talking about this from a Reformed perspective, is that we're not just talking about the crazy stuff because it's cool and weird. And a lot of people do that. And for me, I get exhausted by it at times, because I'm like, yeah, but you're missing the point.
Yeah, because it becomes an into itself. And the reason why we get into it is because it actually helps shine light on the grander story that's the more normal story. But it puts it in, like we've said before, it puts it in living color, or puts it in 3D instead of 2D or black and white.
That's right.
AM radio instead of Dolby THX surround sound.
Wow. There you go. Well, what's fascinating is that the weirder the parts of our Bibles get, the more significant they become. I used to do the opposite with that. Like, well, that's just weird. I don't know. And it doesn't really matter. So you throw it aside. And it's like, it's like when you're building something and you got an extra part, you're like, I don't know what that's for. It's like, you could be missing the entire function of whatever it is that you're using. And you think it's some little small screw or switch that doesn't matter. And what we're trying to say is that I think Paul meant what he said. All of Scripture is profitable. And that's what we're going to get to today, specifically talking about the Tower of Babel. So we'll go back to the story.
Yeah. One more thing that you reminded me of when you were talking a moment ago is Jesus coming down to us. Mm-hmm. One of the terms that's used for that in John 1:14 is that Jesus literally tabernacled among us.
That's right.
Why does that matter? Because a tabernacle is a temple. And so the idea there is that God as the temple has come down to man. The same idea really is true of the tabernacle itself, of course, that God gave the instructions to Moses of how to build a tabernacle. He had to build it exactly according to the pattern, as Exodus and Hebrews says. Why? Because it was a copy of heavenly things. And the point was, God is giving him the instructions for how to build it. And then, so that means that the directions come from heaven to earth to mm-hmm. Moses, who then builds it. And then God descends from heaven to earth and fills the tabernacle with the presence of his glory and his angel and the Spirit. And so God coming down to us in covenant is just absolutely crucial to understanding that the Tower of Babel story is actually the exact opposite of that.
Yeah, I had this illustration pop in my mind, and it's really dangerous and it may not work out as well. But I think, so we don't live in the idea of tabernacling anymore. Like you and I weren't raised to worship God in his presence in a building. That's just not how we were raised, right?
And at some point in time, we will get to why that's the case.
That's right.
When we start talking about who the sons of God really are in the New Testament and why that's the case.
Yes, and I am looking forward to that. But as strange as it, when Paul and Jesus are saying, you will be the tabernacle, and they're like, what in the are you talking about? It's like, you will become that which houses the presence of God. So we hold something in our hands that's in many ways it tabernacles, it holds within it a power to connect to the world. And that's our phones. Most everybody has one of these, right? And so you and I would agree that in our hands, we hold a power that connects to the internet and can connect to other people, but we ourselves are not the ones with the power. And they're already talking about, I mean, it's freaking me out, where one day this will be in here.
Yeah, downloaded into your head. I know.
Right. And as strange as that sounds to us, like, that is, there's no way. That's where, like, if we understand tabernacle language, we understand ziggurat language, we understand cosmic, I'm going to introduce a new word right now, a cosmic mountain. This is how the Old Testament mind thought. And then the prophets are coming and saying, and one day you will be the temple. You will be the priest. You will house him. And that was mind-blowing for the New Testament believer. For us, we missed the joke. We missed the punchline because we don't understand the setup, right? We're kind of on the outside of the joke here. So we don't want that to be the case anymore. We want you to understand when he says that he is tabernacling in you, you are the temple of God, that there's a significance to everybody that hears that. So back to the story. Here we go. Back to Babel. So Doug, it's not a tower. What is it?
Okay. So yeah, this is right. It's not a tower. When you look at depictions of in pop culture of what the Tower of Babel looked like, you know, it probably will be a round sort of a circular building, but it will have mm-hmm. stages to it. Mm-hmm. So whether it's a spiraling thing with a staircase that's going around in a circle, or whether it's more square structure or something like what you see in a pyramid.
I think of the Mayans thing.
Yeah.
The Mayan
pyramids especially. So there are some of those in Egypt, but South America has the best examples of these. And they're usually staged in stair kind of styling. Mm-hmm. So there might be 7, sometimes 10, whatever in terms of stages. And then you'll have a staircase that actually is, you know, much littler steps so that little people can walk up it that will take you from the bottom to the top of the thing. Actually, a very interesting one in Mexico, has at the bottom of that, it has a serpent of the actual staircase that you're walking up. It has a serpent head. And then on the summer solstice, the way that the shadow works is it looks like it's got a curving spine on it. So that as the sun is descending or ascending or descending during that day, it looks like the serpent is going up and back down the side of the staircase. That's helping you get a, this is a real thing. Like, go look it up.
That's creepy.
It's really creepy and it's really cool. But the idea is that the, you know, we've talked to think about the Watchers being serpentine kind of beings, that this is a depiction of those sons of God, the heavenly beings coming from the top into heaven and then making their way down to earth. And so what happens is that the tower, which they more formal name for it is a ziggurat, is actually a, you brought up the word a minute ago, it's a cosmic mountain. A cosmic mountain is a meeting place between heaven and earth. It's the place where the gods come on the top of it, and then they deliberate over the affairs of humanity from this mountain. You can think of Mount Olympus as a good example of that, as a picture in your mind for how that works. I want to give you just some names of ziggurats. These are actual names from Babylonian ziggurats, kind of where the whole thing probably started. Just a couple of names. This is found in a paper that John Walton did years ago on ziggurats. And Temple of the Foundation of Heaven and Earth. That's one of the names. Temple of the Stairway to Pure Heaven. Temple of the Mountain Breeze. Temple of the Foundation of Heaven and Earth. Very similar to the other one. So what is that telling you? It tells you that the names of these ziggurats tell you their function. Their function was to be a connection link, a portal between heaven and earth, where now in the case of a ziggurat, it's different than a cosmic mountain in that a ziggurat is man-made and a cosmic mountain is just a mountain. Okay.
Right.
So if it's man-made, then that means it's humans building and erecting a thing going upward. And if it's a real cosmic mountain, it's already been there. And the idea would be that the god or gods or God himself would come down onto the mountain and would then meet with the representative or whoever. So it's really important, I think, to keep people from getting weirded out too much by this, because they think paganism, you know, whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
Daring to talk about mythology and Zeus on Mount Olympus. Well, no, this is a biblical motif that goes from the beginning of the Bible to the end of the Bible. Best place you can see it, of course, is Mount Sinai. God says, I'm going to come to this mountain. And then he goes, in Exodus 19, he goes, all the people, you have to stay there at the bottom. You are not allowed to come up this mountain. Put police tape around it, because if you cross over that line, you're going to be executed. He gives, however, permission to Moses, Aaron, the sons of Aaron, and 70 elders in Exodus 24 to come halfway up the mountain, and they can have dinner with him, and they can see him. And it says they actually saw him with their eyes. But only Moses is allowed to go to the top of the mountain, where he alone will meet with God, receive the law, and then he will then come down as the intercessor to the people. Now, does that sound similar to any other kind of a thing that we have in the Bible? And the answer to that is yes. It's exactly the pattern that we find in the tabernacle and the temple. So what do I mean? Well, I just gave you a three partitioned area of Sinai. You have the outer, you know, the land around the mountain where the people are. You have the mid mountain where the 70 and the priests are. And then you have the top of the mountain where one man is allowed to go. This is exactly what you find in the temple, where the courtyard of the temple is the main space. All the people can go there for offering a sacrifice. Only the priests are allowed to go into the holy place. And only the high priest is allowed to go into the most holy place, and that only once a year. Why? Well, if you were to look down vertically on Mount Sinai, what you would see is that the top of the mountain becomes the center. It's like a bullseye, a target. Okay. And then the mid mountain is the second rung out. And then the ground around it is the third rung out. And this is exactly the idea that you have if you look at a diagram of the temple. You have the courtyard on the outer, you have the holy place, and then the most holy place inside of that.
In the middle.
Okay, so what that means is that the temple and the tabernacle are replicas of the Cosmic Mountain. What they are is they're essentially, they're a way to bring the Cosmic Mountain anywhere. Now, a lot of times they would build them on top of a mountain, of course. You find right. you find temples on top of mountains all the time. Joshua's altar, which it has some features, it was actually, and we know where the actual Joshua's altar from the book of Joshua is. It's on Mount Ebal, and it's been uncovered, and it's inside a giant footprint, which is really weird, probably a Gilgal. And it looks like a very miniature ziggurat. It's got a stair leading up to the top. It's got walls. It's got partitions off, that kind of stuff. It's a miniature temple. And so in building a temple on the ground or a tabernacle, let's say in a wilderness where it can move around, what you're doing is you're allowing for there to be the place where God can then come and meet with his people. Now, in the case of the tabernacle, as we just said, God is the one who gives the directions of how to build it, because God is the one who says, I'm going to come and reside there. This was not Israel's idea. It was not Moses's idea. Moses isn't doing any incantations to bring God to come to live there. This is all God's idea, because he's covenanting with Moses on Mount Sinai. And this is a really interesting thing, John. I think we were talking before we started recording this, that God, whenever you see a covenant, that God makes a covenant with his people, you always see a temple and a mountain nearby it. Like, what are you talking about? Well, okay, we just did Moses and Mount Sinai. If we go backward, just two covenants in biblical order, the way that we usually talk about them, you come to Noah. Well, what is the temple there? It's Noah's Ark. And it's got three tiers. It's a three-tiered structure, and it's got all kinds of language in it that's connected to temples. And where does it land?
On Ararat.
Mount Ararat. And that's then what happens? He offers a sacrifice on the mountain.
Sacrifice.
God comes to him on the mountain. It's a cosmic mountain. You can go backwards one more to Eden. If you go and read Ezekiel 28, you find that Eden is called the Mountain of God. Well, I thought it was a garden. What is a garden? But the garden's at the bottom. But think about it. It's got a river going through it. The river has to come from somewhere higher up. That higher up becomes Mount Eden. And who's there? Well, God is there. And he put Adam onto this place. And then to add kind of the weird stuff to it with Eden, you have Satan there. Why is he there? Well, because this is where the divine council is. The divine council's on these mountains. This is why Deuteronomy 33 verse 2 and Stephen's speech and Paul talk about how angels were intercessors of the law. Well, where locationally were they? Well, they were on the mountain with Moses. Why? Because that's where the divine council is. You know, you can see this with all the covenants, and you can think about Abraham. God tells him to sacrifice his son. And where does he tell him to do it? On top of Mount Moriah. Okay. What about David? Well, of course, David gets the instructions for the temple from God. And then where does he build it? Mount Zion. And that's a covenant. All of these are covenantal things. A God coming to us on a mountain with a temple and a covenant. Why? Because the Cosmic Mountain is the place that links heaven and earth. God, in the biblically speaking, God is the one condescending to us, inviting us or bringing us up to him. And then the representative, the federal head, goes back down to the people and then disseminates the information of the covenant to his posterity. Of course, we see this in the New Testament too, just to finish it off.
Yeah.
Jesus tabernacling among us, same idea. And he says he is the temple. And where's the temple? On the mountain. And so Jesus becomes the link between heaven and earth. Something that really freaks people out is Jacob's ladder, because we're used to thinking of it as a ladder to heaven, like, you know, stairway to heaven, you know, climbing up the rungs, and Jacob's ladder. And Huey Lewis has a song about that, all that kind of stuff.
That's right.
No, it's not a ladder. It's a ziggurat. It's a cosmic mountain. God's at the top, and then the angels are ascending and descending upon this place, and Jacob's at the bottom, and he meets God there. He calls it Bethel, the house of God. Well, what does Jesus say in John 1:51? He says, you will see the Son of Man, or you will see the angels ascending and descending on the Son of Man. When? When he's lifted up. Where? On the cross, which is where? On Mount Calvary.
That's right. I was just going to ask you that.
Because Jesus is the cosmic mountain. He's the embodiment of it, the fullness of it. And then when you get to the church itself, we become the body of that. And so we become, in a figurative sense, we become Mount Zion. We become the place where God's presence is in his spirit. And we become the intercessory link, the stairway, the portal, whatever, between heaven and earth. So what are they doing at the Tower of Babel? They're trying to do this all their way.
By themselves. That's right. Yeah. No, this is powerful. So I want to get to that in a minute, the whole Tower of Babel, but I want to kind of reword in my own brain because I'm listening to you bring this all together. You know, when we hear the Psalms or David and you hear the Israelites talk a lot about Mount Zion and how they long for it and desire it, which is always, you know, a weird statement to say. And then we get to the New Testament, we don't talk that way anymore. Well, what was lost in the Mount of Mount Eden, right? In the garden, what was lost there? It was us being in the presence of our Creator and being in communion with him, which is what he promises to restore. But until the restoration happens, God has to condescend to us in his own way. And as you said, he keeps setting up these covenants. And each covenant, one, I think, gives us a greater understanding and access to the King, to our God. But ultimately, it helps you understand how God interacts. And to the moment where it's like when Jesus comes and becomes it's no longer a temple, it's no longer a mountain. He is the embodiment and person of God. And then it gets even crazier because he's like, I need to leave because the temple, am handing that over to you, and you are now going to have the presence of God in you. I mean, it's this amazing buildup to where you start with the presence of God in a mountain with humanity being in its presence. And at the end of the story, it's reversed to we are the walking mountains. We are the walking temples.
Yeah.
And what are we doing? We're bringing humanity to God through us. Which is, I'm jumping the gun here a little bit. You know, what do they call it? Jumping the shark or whatever. But
hopefully not jumping the shark.
I don't want to jump the shark. As soon as I said that, I am jumping the gun. I got it right. I get my metaphors mixed up or something.
There's a passage that is very important to what you just said. That's a prophecy in Isaiah 2. And this is what Israel was supposed to do, but it's what the church ends up doing through Christ's work.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
The word of Isaiah, son of Amos, saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem, it shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established as the highest of the mountains. And it will be lifted up above the hills, and all the nations shall flow to it. And many people shall come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways, that we may walk in his paths. Out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He shall judge between nations. He shall decide disputes of many peoples. They shall beat their swords into plowshares, their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. You can hear they're going up to where God is. He's making judgments. This is all divine counsel stuff. Micah actually literally lifts this straight out of Isaiah and puts it in his book. So it's actually, we find this in more than one place. It's such an important prophecy, and it's exactly what you just talked about.
Right. Now, listen, I know if you're listening to this episode because you got tagged by the title and you're like, divine counsel, what is that? You got to go back and listen to the series that we did on that. But what we want to keep doing is helping you tie all this story together. It's not people were bad, God used Israel to bring the Messiah, and now we're in the New Testament, we don't need the old. The New Testament is the fulfillment, the setup, that like the crescendo of the old. And so you can't start with, you know, season 2 and think you're going to fully understand, and in my opinion, be fully impacted as you should, unless you start with season 1, which is the setup, right? So this is what we're trying to do, even with the simple story of a ziggurat, like even understanding that word and understanding the concept. So let's do a little bit of review, and we may have to pick this up next week. So let's do a little bit of review so that people, you know, we can connect it all. So you're saying that from the way the story flows, God starts his communion and interaction with humanity on a mountain, Eden, which happens to have a garden. Is this correct?
Yes.
And then what you see is that God continues to interact with them and making covenants when he, in his terms, is doing so. You see him using these, we could say, cosmic mountain. Cosmic mountain would be a good definition of where God connects heaven and earth on his terms.
Right.
Right. So, and ultimately, we'll get to this probably in the next episode. We'll finally get to a New Testament connection. We've alluded to it a couple of times. The reason why the story of the Tower of Babel is so important is that instead of God condescending to man and doing it on his terms through his rules, we're reversing the role, basically saying we're going to do it ourselves with our own strength and our own power.
And I would argue that they're going to do it through a bunch of other entities other than the Lord.
Hmm. Well, that's what I wanted to ask you about and getting us in for next week, is that they building the Tower of Babel for Yahweh or for the gods of the other, for other gods?
That sounds like a good way to leave it for next week.
Who was the Tower of Babel built for? So, all right. Well, that is, I think this is the first time we've actually got an episode in 30 minutes, but I thought it was a good stopping point. Doug and I try to use our time wisely. We're pastors and we do other ministries and podcasts. So we feel like 30 minutes is pretty good. So we're going to push pause here. And if you're upset with us, then I've already said in the comments, it's like, you guys are the worst. You cut off right at the good part. Well, that's good. We hope you come back for next week. But we're going to pick this back up and continue the story of understanding the gods, the divine council, how God interacts with us, ziggurats and mountains, and how, in our opinion, it all plays into the gospel. And as he said, I'll allude this to you now, the church becomes the cosmic mountain. So next week, we'll help make that connection. So come back and listen. Thanks, Doug.